keeping our attention a bit on climate and adding other weather kinds of issues to the conversation here. Now, Larry Mueller here. Steve Ackerman with us next. He's director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison, a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. A little bit later, around noontime, John Martin will join us, professor and former chair of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. So we'll take a look at spring. What does it look like? We can take a look back at what the weather was the last quarter or so, and you can call in with your own weather and climate questions. I hope you'll join us. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Steve Ackerman with us by phone today. Hi, Steve.
Hello, Larry. How you doing?
Good. You're at a conference?
I am splitting this week between reviewing a program at Texas A&M. You know, peer review is real big, yeah. Not just in the publications, but as in programs, so I'm helping them out with that, and then going to a conference in D.C. later in the week. So I'm enjoying low 80-degree temperatures.
It's not like that here, for sure.
It's not there, yes. But it is humid here, too, which is kind of yucky, but...
So spring is officially here, actually.
It is officially here, you know, both astronomically and meteorologically. You know, meteorologically, spring begins on March 1st, typically. So we look at the months of March, April, and May as our spring months.
So, well, let's look back for a minute. Do we have official results or any kind of results on the kind of winter we just had?
Yeah, we do. So the winter overall looks like it's going to be warmer than normal. That's how it's probably going to turn out. So the last month has been certainly actually been on average, so not too much warmer than average conditions. So that hasn't been too bad. For seasonally, you know, snowfall... If I take a quick look at that, snowfall was pretty close to normal as well, a little bit above normal.
It's kind of nice to hear normal once in a while.
It's kind of nice to hear normal. The ice on the Great Lakes was a bit below normal. You know, certainly wasn't like what we had in 2012, which was a pretty cold winter.
As we look back, the trend, has it been to a bit warmer in the winter?
Generally, the trend has been overall over the last 15, 20 years to be warmer than normal, for sure. Particularly, the minimum temperatures have really been increasing over the last 20 years or so, which has made the average wintertime temperature go up. So we still have winter, but it's just not as severe as cold as it has been in the past.
The weather seems to be, to me anyway, more changeable than normal. We were talking a bit about that with our previous two guests, Chris Kacharik and John Greenler, and how it may affect agriculture here in the state. But it does. Is that the case? We had a listener report last week. He had hail on one side of the road, snow on the other side of the road. This kind of becoming a normal situation?
You know, it's the studies, you know, so when you're looking at these extreme changes or changes that don't occur very often, like hail, you really need a good time period in order to look at what those changes are. But one of the things we're seeing throughout the nation as we look at precipitation data is that it tends to be coming in more intense amounts. So even if the precipitation is only going up a little bit, what we're finding is that when it comes, it generally is coming in fewer events and therefore heavier precipitation.
Tom in Oshkosh has a question. Let's go there. Tom, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you. My sister, who lives in Seattle, sent me a picture of a mist bowl over the ocean. And I've never heard that term before. What is a mist bowl?
Mist bowl.
A mist bowl, huh. So did it look like a fog?
It's foggy, kind of a rainbow foggy type thing, yes.
Oh, okay. Was there, oh, So is it a, is it have color in it or just like a white arc?
That's kind of a white arc.
Yeah, yeah. So I've never heard it called a fist bowl.
No, mist.
A mist bowl, but I haven't heard it called a fog bowl.
Oh, okay.
And it's, and I'm going to guess it's basically the same thing, and it's the same type of process that forms rainbows, and that is the sun is at your back, and when it hits the fog droplets or the rain droplets in the case of a rainbow, as the light goes into that droplet, it reflects off the back of the droplet and then comes out the front. And in a rainbow, the raindrops are big enough that as it goes in and out of the drop, the colors get to separate because the speed of the colors changes. Whereas in a fog bowl or in a mist bowl, the droplets are not big enough to see that separation of colors. And so it just appears as a white arc.
I see. Thank you.
Yeah. All right. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call.
It's something I've always wanted to see but haven't. and I had a chance one morning in a meeting in Alaska where I went to breakfast at 7:30, and those who went to breakfast at 7 o'clock in the morning, there was still a fog in the valley, and they got to see the fog bow, but I missed it.
You missed it. And have you ever seen one?
No, I haven't. Because it takes very special conditions. One is you need a fog, obviously. The second is you need to have the sun at your back, so you have to do it usually early in the morning because that's typically when you have fogs. And then you have to be high enough up above the fog to actually see the light being reflected off of the fog layer. So it, it takes a special kind of situation that doesn't occur very much in Madison.
No, I don't think it. I don't think I've ever seen one for sure.
Yeah.
Oh man. Well, I tell you what. The long-range weather forecast. Somebody asked me about that and how they're put together and how reliable are they. And we've talked about this in the past a little bit, but maybe you can comment on that for us.
Yeah, they're the long-range ones. So when we look at seasonal forecasts in particular, a lot of that is done statistically. So, you know, where we're looking at in the past when we had these conditions in March, for example, what does that portell for what's coming, you know, the next month or 2 or 3 months from now? And those really depend on certain events. So for us in Wisconsin, the seasonal forecast for what winter is going to look like is often tied to whether or not there's an El Nino period going on. And that if we're in neutral El Nino type conditions like we are now, it's really hard to forecast what the future winter is going to be looking like. But I will say this, that this seasonal forecasting is identified as one of our grand challenges in weather forecasting. And so there's more research going into that, more people in terms of university researchers, but also the National Weather Service are looking at how can we improve that seasonal forecast, not just statistically, but by improving our numerical weather prediction models, as well as bringing in more weather data to initialize those models as they do their run.
That's got to be really tough.
It's tough, but you know, I think the importance of it is...
Yeah, talk about that.
Yeah, so, for any kind of planning, for example, in agriculture, also in energy industry, in the transportation industry, you know, the more detail you can have out with regard to the weather, you know, so being able to know what April weather is going to be like is really good for planning, right? In agriculture, yeah. I think it's pretty obvious with regard to when do you plant, when do you water, you know, when do you put pesticides on, et cetera. So it's really important to the economy to be able to do that long-range forecast.
But do you think it's ever going to be, 3 months out?
3 months out, it gets pretty hard, I think. You know, one of the things, though, you know, just looking at my own career, you know, if you would have told me 15 years ago, that we could get an accurate 8-day forecast, you know, I would have shook my head like, yeah, we'll see. But, you know, we're there now, right now. You know, I'll look at a week-ahead forecast and, you know, get a sense of whether or not the conditions are going to be favorable for severe weather and things like that, or whether or not it's going to be, you know, potentially heavy raining or abnormal rain or abnormally dry. So we're getting better on the week forecast. And so I think seasonal forecasts are always going to be a challenge, but I think the sub-seasonal, where we're talking about a month, I think we're going to be getting better and better at that over the next couple of years.
And a month would be wonderful to have.
A month would be wonderful, right, particularly for, you know, even if you do your own gardening, to know whether or not April is going to be a wet year or not, right? That would be a valuable thing to know in terms of planting.
Absolutely. Steve Ackerman, our guest today, and we'll take some calls, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@WPR.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. We've got a caller coming up here. Let's just take Annie in La Crosse. Annie, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Say, I do farmer's market. And last year was the sloppiest, wettest farmer's market we've ever had. And I'm wondering if you have any ideas about what this spring and summer are going to do as far as rain goes. And I will hang up and listen on the radio.
And you're in the La Crosse area, of course.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a tough. Doing a summer forecast for Wisconsin is always tough because, particularly in terms of precipitation, because our precipitation really comes in thunderstorms. And so, you know, we can, in the county, you know, get a thunderstorm that just goes north of Madison, right? And then mm-hmm. we miss it. And so it's really hard to do those summertime forecasts a couple of months out in advance. So my guess would be, you know, plan on going to the market, and before you go, look and see if you need an umbrella.
Well, she's talking about selling at the market.
Oh, selling, yeah. Well, that's the other issue, right, is, again, planning for that. And I think, you know, if you're making a living off of doing that, then you just have to plan to go, and you just have to be prepared for that type of weather when it occurs.
Well, you still have to take your umbrella.
You still have to take your umbrella and make sure you tie down your tents in case the wind really picks up.
Well, this is a record short period of time that you and I get to talk, and I know you've got other things going on today, Steve, so I appreciate it. John will be wandering into the studio pretty quickly now. In the meantime, thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure. It's been great. I'm sorry to have missed this. I told them, do it whenever you want, but don't pick the last week in March.
And of course, that's when
they picked it.
Well, have fun, Steve. Thank you.
Thank you.
Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW. John Martin coming up right after this look at the news. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here taking a look at climate and weather today with our weather guys, but it's a weather guy right now. Yeah, John Martin is with us, professor and former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. And he is here to answer your weather questions. What weather questions have you got? I hope you'll join in, maybe your climate questions as well. The number 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@WPR.org or go ahead and post on our Facebook page, titled The Larry Mueller Show. And John Martin, welcome back.
Thank you, Larry. Good to be here.
When is spring? Well, spring's here officially. I talked about that a little bit with Steve, but when is it going to be here really?
That's a good question. You know, the old story is the first day of spring is one thing. The first spring day is quite another. So we've been waiting for that, I guess, haven't we? We haven't really had a really breakthrough spring day, except those few in February where we're 68 degrees and all the snow melted. It doesn't look obvious to me that we're going to have that first big, you know, blush of warm weather for spring in the near future, 4, 5, 6 days. It doesn't look like it. So it's going to be postponed a little bit.
So we're going to have what we've got right now.
Yeah, this sort of incessant slop. You know, it's not really cold out, but it's not nice. You can't go out and do much in it, and it's hard for the ground to dry because it's not sunny and so on. So, yeah, it's not that nice right now.
We had an unexpected freeze a few weeks ago, I think, and then right after a warm spell, what was it, February, we had a couple.
Yeah, 22nd to 27th or something like that.
About a week of that. Can we expect more cold snaps before summer, do you think?
You know, that's a really good question. We've got some research going on right now that's looking at exactly questions like this. When does the winter end in certain years? We're looking at a time series of that. And when does the spring actually begin? It's almost the same question, but sometimes it's not exactly the same question. We're trying to figure out how to phrase it. But I think, you know, we've had snow as late as, measurable snow as late as the 8th, 9th, or 10th of May. So we're not really out of the woods, I would say, you know, in terms of real cases that have happened in the last 30 or 40 years until mid-May. That's not usual. I'd say maybe the more usual situation is probably after about the second weekend in April. You can fairly well count on it not really getting bitterly cold. It'll be cold in the sense that you'd like it to be 60 degrees and not windy, and there'll be a baseball game you got to go and watch with your kid playing where it's 42 and windy, but the sun will be out. It'll feel terrible, but it won't be bitterly cold. So I don't think we're really out of the woods till mid-May. I'm sorry to say. I think that's, if you set your sights on mid-May and you're disappointed then, you got a real gripe. If you have a gripe or you know, complaint before then, you haven't been looking at the records.
Well, it's spring. You know, it's my spring. Steve was saying, spring is essentially, we think about it as March, April, and May.
Right. That's right. And some places, that's really not as true as it is in others. I think in Chattanooga, March, April, and May must be really nice. But in Madison, March, April, and May aren't that nice. In Houghton, Michigan, I don't think you get nice till June 1st, June 10th.
Well, let's talk a little bit about long-range forecasting. I visited just briefly with Steve about that, but how do they actually put these together, these forecasts?
It depends on the time scale you're talking about. I think seasonal forecasts are based on a small amount of some what we call deterministic forecasting. That is, you take an initial condition set and you plow it forward through your equations that are converted into computer code, and then the computer tries to tell you what the evolution of the atmosphere will be. And the accuracy of that depends on a lot of things. It depends on the accuracy of your initial conditions. It also depends on the power of your computer and some of the ways in which you have to deal with processes that are on a very small scale in the atmosphere that are sometimes underneath or below, I should say, below the mesh size of the model that you're using. So in other words, you'd be like trying to catch minnows in a giant net. You're not going to do that very well. And so the amalgamation of all of those small processes can really steer the forecast off the tracks after about 10 days. So you can't really depend on a deterministic forecast to go much longer than that. So you blend those kinds of insights with statistical insights based on large-scale correlations between where the sea surface temperature is warm or cold and various other types of things in the atmospheric flow and how they've correlated in the past. And you make a projection based on what those conditions look like now as to how it might evolve in the two-week, three-week, four-week time frame.
A lot goes into it.
A lot goes into it, and it's really not a very settled science. I think it's probably beyond the horizon for what we'll be able to do, maybe for a very long time.
Yeah. Kelly in Jefferson has something for us. Hi, Kelly.
Hi.
What can we do for you today?
What is the difference between partly cloudy and partly sunny skies?
I think the difference is your outlook. That's a really good question, Kelly. Yeah, I don't know if there's a numerical characterization of that difference. My profession is not forecasting the weather, so if there is a numerical designation, I wouldn't be aware of it. But I like to say that it depends on how optimistic a person is. I would characterize a day as partly sunny. Others might characterize it as partly cloudy. I don't really know what the distinction is. It's a very good question.
But you hear it all the time.
Yeah, it's true.
On television weather.
Yeah. Maybe it would be 60-40 one way or the other. If it's partly sunny and it's 60% of the time it's sunny, that would be a reasonable description as opposed to partly cloudy if it's only 40% cloudy. But I honestly don't know if that's the way it's done.
If there's a couple of clouds in the sky, you're going to say, oh, it's pretty sunny.
I think so. I would say, you know, in summer days we get a few clouds that kind of pop up. I would never call that a partly cloudy day. I'd say this is a sunny day. You know, you get a cloud here or there, it's not the same as partly cloudy.
And that's probably what those weather forecasters use on TV.
I think that's right. I mean, if I get up in the morning and I imagine the sky's going to be filled with a lot of fair weather cumulus clouds, I'll call that day partly cloudy. But if I think it's going to be mostly a few, you know, whiffy clouds going by, I'm not going to say anything about them. Everyone will notice them. They won't be that big a deal.
So there's our very scientific answer.
That is as deep as you can go in that scientific well on that one, you bet.
Thanks, Kelly. Thanks a lot for calling. Kate in Fox Cities, we turn to you next. Hi, Kate.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I you know, there's always a lot of variety between the coldness of a winter and heat of a summer and so forth. But one thing I kind of feel for sure is that we've had more high wind events in the last few years. Is that just because I'm older and I'm paying attention to the weather more, or is there any basis for that?
That's a good question, Kate. You're not the only one who has called us over the past, what, 2 or 3 years now, people suggesting that every once in a while. And we always have said we don't know of anybody studying that, and I've never taken it upon myself to do any analysis of that. It's a very good question. I think maybe finally I will, because this is too many times people asking, is it getting windier? I would suspect the answer is no, but I don't know if that's the case.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's no obvious reason why, with the climate changing subtly as it is, that we ought to get windier here. I don't see that connection, and that's why I say it's not obvious to me that the answer would be yes. So, but worth looking at.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Jim wonders, how does wind develop?
Oh, wind is related to the distribution of mass in the atmosphere, and we measure that at the ground by taking pressure measurements. And so if the pressure difference between two locations is very large, you're going to have a strong wind blowing in the gap between those places. If the pressure difference is small, you won't have a very strong wind. And then in addition to that, gustiness comes from the fact that the air mixes in the vertical. So you can have air moving in relation to that same kind of pressure difference at a level above the ground, moving much faster than the air near the ground. But if it's caught up in some sort of a mixing event, you can drag that high momentum, high velocity air right to the surface, and suddenly the gust can come up 20 miles per hour when you have a steady wind of 5.
And we create that ourselves artificially with buildings, tall buildings.
Yeah, that's true. Some of the mixing is definitely enhanced by tall objects. Absolutely right. So we can artificially stir it up.
Well, I experienced that last week a few times, more than once, as a matter of fact. The idea that I have is, give us a call with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234, email at ideas at WPR.org, or post on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. We'd love to hear from you. Talk about you mentioned briefly some of the research that you guys are doing. Talk a little bit more about the kind of research that goes on in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences.
Yeah, one of the interesting things that a colleague of mine and I are looking at right now is what happens in the month of March. It's a really interesting transition from the winter into the spring. And this is not just in Madison or in Wisconsin, but over the whole Northern Hemisphere. And we're trying to understand how does the processes and structures that exist in the very high latitudes of the Northern Hemisphere, so the polar latitudes, they seem to be, it's difficult during the depths of the winter for those polar disturbances to get themselves involved in our weather in the middle latitudes. But it gets a little bit easier in the month of March. And to the extent that such interaction occurs between the middle latitudes and the polar latitudes in the transition season, the season can be either very stormy or quite placid. I'm not sure how to characterize this much yet. I haven't done the calculation, and I don't want to look at just one location. That would be dangerous, so we try and do a hemispheric calculation of that. And to try and understand how polar and mid-latitude interactions occur as the winter is transitioning to spring is a really interesting question. And to me, and I thought the other day when I was walking around, we got all these flowering plants just about to burst.
Yep.
If you don't get winds in the spring, you don't have as much pollination going on, you know, between trees and various,
sure.
It has to get windy at this time of year. And I wonder if this isn't, you know, it's not like the polar and mid-latitudes know that and therefore get their act together. But nonetheless, it's part of what happens in nature. And so this portion of the year is not so well understood dynamically, and we're trying to better understand it for a variety of reasons.
I never thought of that.
Isn't that kind of cool?
How plants,
that's how so many of them have some kind of sexual activity. Yeah, it's not, there's no other way to do it.
Got to have some breeze.
You got to have wind.
Paul in Tomahawk, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
I do a lot of sailing on Lake Superior, and over the last 10 years, I've noticed that the water temperature has gotten warmer. Mm. But also, I've noticed the change in the wind, especially in August. August used to be a month when there was very little wind on Lake Superior. But now it seems like there's so many times when we have wind just roaring out of the south. We'll have 20 knots of wind blowing steady from the south for several days at a time. wondered if you wanted to comment on that.
Yeah, there was a recent study by a colleague of mine and collaborators, now recent meaning the last 2 or 3 years, I think, where they were looking at Lake Superior temperatures, I believe in the summertime, and noticed exactly what you said. There's been a systematic increase in the top-level surface water temperatures, not so much deep down. It's hard to get that water into play. But when you warm the surface temperatures, there was a correlation with the wind, and I can't remember now what direction it went. Let's just say, to be consistent with your observations, the winds are a little stronger over the lake. That was also noted. And I think they put the two together, warmer surface temperatures and stronger winds, means an enhanced evaporation off the lake at certain times of the year. I think late summer going into the fall, which is not a particularly good thing, because that's one of the ways in which water leaves the lakes and can disappear, you know, because the watershed footprint for the lakes is quite small compared to their size. So if you evaporate water off the lakes and transport it out of the watershed, it's gone forever. And so that's a really big issue. And some of the things that you've observed seem to be physically linked to that problem, which it might be robbing the lakes of water in a more systematic way than used to be the case.
Hmm. Interesting. Thanks, Paul. Appreciate it. Ken in Ladysmith, your turn. Hi, Ken.
Hello. My question was, it seems to me like there's more cloudy days than there used to be.
All right. Are there...
Yeah, that's such a hard question to answer, not only on the regional scale, southern Wisconsin, Dane County, but also globally. People are using satellites to try and make measurements of that, and it's not an easy problem. One of the things that is lurking in the background is the planet's getting a little bit warmer, 1.5 degrees Celsius over the last 100 years. That should increase the water vapor content of the atmosphere, and people are using satellite cloud information as well as other types of observations to try and really pin that down. To the extent that you would have more water vapor in the atmosphere, it's quite logical to expect there'll be more cloudiness. Whether or not that manifests itself the same way everywhere around the globe, or, you know, looks like that here in Madison or in the state of Wisconsin broadly, is hard to say, and I'm not sure that there's any definitive statements yet about increased cloudiness at mid-latitudes based upon observations.
Yeah. But it makes sense.
It makes sense, and it might be one of the ways that the climate system fights back against warming. Because if you have more clouds, you're going to reflect more solar radiation, and so that's, you know, that's certainly a positive, a potential negative feedback on the warming.
Yeah.
To have more clouds, but that depends on weather systems, and it's complicated.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Ken. Appreciate it. Jason in Madison, turning to you next. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Larry. I was wondering if your guest has heard anything about the new cloud types that have been cataloged recently. I believe two new types of clouds were recognized and added to it. I believe it's called a cloud atlas.
Yeah, no, I'm not aware of that. Do you know the names offhand?
I don't. I know I misread it the first time, and one of them looked kind of like asparagus, but I'm not going to be able to pronounce it without looking at it.
Yeah, I wonder about that. I wonder. Do you happen to know what kind of environments they might form in? Sometimes there's new words for clouds that are kind of in hilly country. You know, a Pileus cloud was a relatively new term, not recently, but years ago.
No, I remember one of them being described as, I don't recall where it was formed, but I recall it saying that it looked like...
Uh-oh, we missed him.
Oh, we lost him. Jason, I'm sorry we lost you. That's too bad.
That is too bad. I'm not aware of that. I'm not aware of that. But the Cloud Atlas is the right, that's the description of the tome, I think, that contains all of the different cloud names. So I wasn't aware of that.
We'll have to look into that
one.
Thanks, Jason. I'm sorry we lost you there. Dennis in Stoughton, your turn. Hi, Dennis.
Thank you. I've been wondering about this for a while after listening to you guys. What I'm looking for is a website suggestion that would show, number one, the jet stream pattern over time, with maybe low pressure systems riding over it. And just so, you know, it's my idea that you can predict the weather in a general sense just by looking at those past oscillations of that jet stream. And I guess I've got a pencil ready if you've got some websites that would show that and allow me to manipulate the data so I can see, say, for the last week or the last month.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a really good question. I don't make any product myself that puts both the isotachs, the lines of constant wind speed of the jet, and sea level isobars, which would give you the position of lows and highs, on a single map. There's places, I can't remember the website name, son of a gun. Try this. Try the name Kyle Griffin. Kyle Griffin's maps in a Google search.
Okay.
He's a former graduate student of mine, and he really did make some really spectacular products that use forecast and historical data to give you, I think, about a 10 or a 12-day window. So you can look over a period of time over various parts of the world. You could look at the Pacific, North Pacific Basin, North America, the Atlantic, and so on. So you have to, once you get to his page, Kyle Griffin's maps, you have to kind of pick the area that you want to look at and then pick the variables. I think one of those choices is 200 millibar winds and sea level pressure. And that sounds like what you want to find.
Mm-hmm.
And they're really quite nice-looking maps. I'm not sure they're going to help you in the way that I think I understand, which is you want to see whether or not long-term trends tell you anything about predicting the weather, because I think these are limited to 12 or 14-day windows. But it might be a good place to start.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
And all I was going to add is that, you know, up here, the Chicago Weather Station used to give the most dramatic and informative views of, you know, when you want to watch the weather, we always turn to Chicago.
Yeah, WGN maybe?
Yep.
Oh, you bet.
That was available.
Yeah. Tom Skilling has fought for his entire career to get an almost eight-minute weather presentation, and that is fantastic. And he shows great things on there, the jet and the position of the jet and relative to cyclones and precipitation. He does a great job. You're right to look for that.
Yeah. Thank you very much for calling. And Robert in Ashland, your turn. Hi, Robert.
Hi, how you doing?
Great, appreciate the call.
Yeah, that one fellow mentioned about a cloud, a new cloud. I don't think it was two new clouds that were designated, just one, and it was on Science Friday, either last Friday or the Friday before.
Oh, okay.
And it escapes me right now, the name of it. I live up here in a beach house right on Shawamigan Bay, right on Lake Superior, overlooking overlooking on the other side, Washburn. And a couple of weeks ago, I had a question for your weather guy there.
Yeah.
2 weeks ago, we had sustained winds of 50, 60 miles an hour for 2 days straight without any storm.
Whoa.
Oh, yeah, you know where the storm was. I think I'm right. I think I remember this because it was just over the border in Canada. The storm was intense. Yes. It was a very intense storm in central Ontario. There was no clouds, right? It was clear sky?
Clear sky, no clouds. And it blew sand, even though it's winter, it blew sand 30, 40 yards and covered, you know, from the beach side. It's right over the water, actually, in a boathouse.
Yeah.
It blew sand 20 yards, 2 feet deep.
That's awesome. You know, I can tell you that we didn't have those kind of winds down in Madison, but my windows rattled, and it was the same condition. Clear skies, there was nothing going on. And I remember thinking to myself, that is a monster storm over central Ontario. And so it gets back to the prior question somebody asked earlier about where do the winds come from. If the pressure is really low in the center of that storm, even though it's 400 miles north of you, you get a huge pressure difference, and that drives incredible winds. That was a really unusual event, and it fits into our idea about what happens in March.
Yes.
Something really wild happens in March. So that's a neat observation.
Yeah, thanks so much, Robert. Appreciate it very much. Gail in Fish Creek has something on that cloud category. Hi,
oh,
Gail.
Cool.
Well, first, because I'm originally from Illinois, Skillings is a weather god.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, he is.
Oh, my God, since my childhood I've been watching him. But I'm calling about the new cloud category of the undulatus aspiratus.
Oh, undulated.
Where they whirl and they dip. And I remember seeing these things years ago, and I had called in about them in a show that was talking about the clouds, and nobody was sure what they were and was talking about them. And now they actually have photos of them, and somebody championed trying to get them as a category. They are scary, spooky.
I've seen them, too. Now, you know, as soon as you say the word, and it's weird that the word would do it, but I think I can recall some prior conversations about this. I've seen them, too, and they are really dramatic. They look like something a horror, you know, movie director would want to put in his sky for a scene. Yeah, they're really wild.
Thank you for that, Gail. I'm glad we got that answer.
Yeah, me too. That's great.
John, here we are quickly out of time. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
You'll be back the last Monday of April.
I will. It'll be the last time class conflicts for several months.
April 24th, as a matter of fact. John Martin, professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Great to have him with us. Tomorrow at this time, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk will be back and talk about rabies vaccinations, and we'll start a new segment called Breed of the Month. In the meantime, thank you for listening. Please stay with us. Lots in store.